listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, somebody moved my chair. That's all I can say. Somebody moved my chair.
Look at that.
Hey, it's great to be back. Rob, you did a great job last time on the podcast.
Thank you.
Everybody.
So you haven't heard it yet, then?
I did hear it. It was kind of fun. I kind of miss being there. But, yeah, you did a great job, Rob. And before we get going, let me introduce the panel, both of them.
Bookends.
That's right. We've got Scott Gershon here on my right.
Hello.
And we've got Rob Arbert here on my left.
Back to just being a panel member.
And we asked Andrew if he wanted to sit in, but he was a little tired.
He's too tired.
Bobby is not here. And I don't know if I should be concerned, because when I wasn't here, Bobby was here.
That's true. And he hadn't been here a while before.
Yeah, you know, that's right. I'm noticing they actually are looking similarly.
Yeah.
Maybe there is no Bobby. Yeah. Maybe I am Bobby. Bobby's not.
Bobby's your other, you know, alter ego.
I guess Bobby's swamped with work because, you know, you got to do it while you have it. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, he can't make it today. And quite frankly, I don't even think he was actually here the last time. He probably just went to his place, recorded it, and chopped it all.
Yeah, we just do a really good impression.
You find an English guy on the street and just throw him in, you know.
And Martin, he can't be with us right now. But we're going to gather gather.
No word here on the podcast.
We're going to gather everybody on the next podcast because we have some pretty good shows coming up with some really great guests. This podcast, boy, I hope we can make it through it, because I think between the four of us, we have maybe a total of, what, 6 hours of sleep?
If we're lucky.
I think so.
This is going to be the Audio Nodcast. Okay, really quick, Rob, how many hours of sleep did you get last night?
I'd say about 3.5.
Wow. Scott?
Sleep?
Yeah.
I've been exposed to pretty much 120 dB for 12 hours a day for the last 5 days. So, all my organs have shifted a little bit.
That's right, because you're working on that mixing a movie right now.
Yeah, I'm working on a movie called Shoot 'Em Up. It's got guns.
really?
And cars.
Shoot them up.
and I think we've actually experimented with how loud you can go with a gunshot in the theater. And I think we've pretty much hit the same volume that a gunshot is in nature. A lot. So,
Are these the same guns we talked about you recording last time?
Yeah. We actually used a lot of the stuff from the gun recording. And, you know, it's a movie that, you know, we're not going to apologize for, because there's a lot of guns in it. And it's a lot of fun. It's an e-ticket ride. And, you know, we wanted to, you know, match the visuals, because when you see the movie, it's about guns. And it's a little violent, and there's nudity, and there's, you know.
So it's a chick flick.
You know, actually what it is actually a movie that looks more like a video game.
Oh, that's cool.
In the way that, you know, like you play a video game and everyone shoots each other up, then it's pretty much the movie. And
wait, it's not like that Quake movie? Or,
no, you know what? Quake. It's actually got Paul Giamatti, Clive Owen, Monica Bellucci. So
it was Doom.
Doom. No, there's actually an interesting plot through the whole movie. But yes, it's kind of a dark version of James Bond. But it's just, you know.
That's cool.
It's all based around the gun industry, and there's a lot of guns. So hearing bang, bang, you know, and you got to remember, when we're mixing, we mix 10 minutes and pretty much a whole day. Wow. So you take that 10 minutes over and over and over, and let me re-EQ the gunshot. No. You know, and you're like, okay.
Do you reference 85 dB?
Yes, and I have this wonderful 10K tone in my ear that just keeps going up. So
how do you? But how do you guys do that? That's loud, you know.
It is loud, and not only that, 85 is zero.
Yeah, you're way above that.
We're easily 100 plus dB.
Wow.
And but you know what? When you watch it the first time, it's an e-ticket. I mean, we move the room, and when somebody either gets hit, or when that, you know, the payoff gunshot within a specific scene, you feel it. It's a physical thing.
Yeah, the blood drippings at 85 dB.
You know, so. It'll be interesting. We'll be previewing it pretty soon, and we'll see what people think.
I just want to see it, just to hear the guns being cut in. I got a question, though. When you mix, okay, if your zero's at 85, Are you using an analog VU to get your levels, or are you going off of a digital meter to get your?
No. We have 20 dB of headroom, so okay. You know, zero is at minus 20.
Okay.
At 85 dB, so I'm not exactly sure how loud we can get, but we've gotten there, and you know, and with limiters, it's great because you can stay there all day long. And no, actually, we've been mixing on the Phonics console. And we've got
so your dialogue hangs out at about minus 20, about zero.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but we're pushing it hard because we got a lot of big music's happening.
Right.
So we're pushing. I would say everything's being pushed a little bit more aggressively than normal. And for effects, I've got two machines at about 180 tracks, and then I got a third machine that's probably 64 tracks.
Wow.
And then another machine, which is dialogue, at 64 tracks.
Wow.
So, you know, we're doing with probably, what, four or 500 tracks.
Wow. So you hang around minus 20 dialogue somewhere around there and gives you all the headroom for your gunshots, you know.
Yeah, you know, it is one of the biggest things that when I looked at the film that I'm going for, it's easy to get loud. It's easy to stay loud. The question is, how do we create dynamics? So
right. What
we're doing is we're actually it kind of reminds me drawing negative space. So you start, instead of with a blank canvas, you start with a black sheet, and you start erasing away those areas that you want quiet. So we're actually inverting the concept. So saying, yeah, look, we know we're going to be loud here. It's going to rock and roll, and music's going to be, you know, just kicking there.
Right.
And so now the question is not where do we get louder. The question is where do we get softer.
Oh, that's cool.
So the whole, you know, it's just a conceptual idea of going backwards.
Yeah, totally opposite.
Yeah.
You start at your peaks and you look for your valleys as opposed to start at the valleys and looking for the peaks.
And when you want to find where you want to have a big payoff sound, you don't figure out how loud you're going to get. You figure out how to get quiet right before it.
Wow.
So you can create contrast.
Huh.
So, but it's been great. The director's been loving it and studio's loving it. And it's been a fun experience. Just a little tiring.
Yeah, no kidding. So let's see. We got three from Rob. We've got what? Four? Five?
I stopped counting.
Andrew, how many hours?
4 hours.
4 hours. I was at 4.5. I was supervising a 5-1 mix at 8 a.m. this morning. And
wow.
It was just like brutal till 7. And yeah, the whole thing, just brutal. Brutal day. So, yeah. So, everybody, you know, I hope you guys stay awake because we are trying to stay awake too. But anyhow, yeah. So I was not here last time and I was in New York. And let me just tell you, New York, what an amazing town. What an amazing city. And what really blew me away was, you know, we basically, you go to New York, you're in Blade Runner with all those digital signage that they have there. It's truly phenomenal how big those LED screens can be.
Times Square.
Yeah, it was just amazing. And then, you know, I got to see a couple shows and one thing that, you know, I was mentioning this when you guys called me on the cell phone. For as much of the innovation that we've had in sound, I can't believe they don't have a better way to mic actors on stage in a musical. Because I saw two musicals. I saw The Drowsy Chaperone, which is really good, and mm-hmm. I saw Hairspray. And Hairspray, the mic literally had a couple of the actors went over the top of the mm-hmm. head and right in between yeah. their eyes. And fine, if you're going to hide it under a wig, that works. But when it's a really, you know, tight afro,
yeah.
and you see that when they go to a profile, you see this cable that just goes on top of the head.
And the mic is at the top of their nose?
It's right, literally.
It's in the forehead.
It's literally at the forehead. And I'm thinking, why didn't they come in on the side? Or,
a lot of times they do because they don't want to hear the rustling of the costumes.
But, you know.
And they can do costume changes.
But
faster.
I know lav mics, there's, you know, broadcast lav mics, the ones, you know, I've bought a couple that have, you know, cable that does not transmit, wire up. It's a silent cable that doesn't transmit the vibrations up the wire. So I don't know. I just looked at that and I just couldn't believe that they would go from the back of the head. You saw this wire that went right over the top and it stopped right in between. And granted, you know, the mics, I guess from the, you know, the balcony, you probably could barely make them out, but you know, we were sitting down there in an orchestra. We were about 12 rows back, and it was. I found myself looking at the mic. It was distracting.
Not to do a side story, but it is about that. Is that I saw that on a show once, And then I got hired by DreamWorks for a movie called Spirit about horses.
Right.
And I needed to record horses. And I remembered seeing that in a play. So I took radio mics and I put the radio mic right between its eyes.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, had 8 radio mics and let the horses just go out in the field and do what they were going to do and socialize. And I learned that technique from theater.
Well, that's, hey, what if you, on those recordings, you heard the horse go, "Hey, Charlie, how's it going?" "Oh, it's going good."
Wilbur. Well, my job was actually, DreamWorks was to work with a horse whisperer and to start studying the language of horses.
Really? So the horse was whispering?
Yeah. I just realized they don't say anything.
That's right. When is he leaving? Okay. So anyhow, yeah, I just couldn't believe they couldn't come up with a better way to mic actors. I mean, you want to make a fortune right now, come up with a way that looks good to mic actors in Broadway, because I think everybody would do it. Well, the first play we saw, they came in right over the eyebrow, and that I think was a little less glaring.
But did you think, like, man, what a
big
weird eyebrow?
No, because it was, at least it came in off the side, you know. But when you're right, I mean, literally right in between the forehead, yeah. that was just kind of weird. But I will tell you this, just the state of the sound system and the mixer, I mean, there's some real talent there, especially in Hairspray. There's certain parts where the mixer would push the sub and would pull the sub back, and you go from the sound sounding like it's coming out of a radio to the sound coming full stage production numbers. And it was just phenomenal. I mean, those guys have their act together. They didn't miss a cue, and it was just all – well, not that I know if they didn't miss a cue. But it was just an amazing – you know, really, you know, living in L.A., you just don't have that appreciation for live theater, because, you know, we have the bigger theaters out here, and sure, we get the touring companies. But when you get to see it in an intimate setting like that where they, you know, do it often, and
right,
and it's the home for the whatever production it is. It's truly phenomenal. Especially the PA and the mixers and everybody. They really had their act together. And the musicians. I don't know if any of you guys know much about playing for a Broadway show or show musicians, but those guys were just phenomenal. I mean,
I see them reading books a lot. They're like, read a book. And then pick the book back up and start reading.
Well, it made me – I went on the net and I started, you know, just going – you know, went to the union page that mm-hmm. was talking about it. And it's just – it's really phenomenal how much they cover. I went and looked in the pit, and I – you know, you're hearing this full band and you expect there to be, you know, a full-on, you know, 20-piece ensemble. And it was like, you know, 8 guys. And you're like, holy – smokes. I mean, that's you know, talk about talent. And they were so tight and they were so good. So I just got to give props to that. And it was really interesting when they were on the website, just as a little side, when they're talking about how to get a job in a Broadway show and about Broadway, how Broadway is becoming kind of like the studio scene of years gone by. Because if you're a professional musician, and apparently in New York, if you want to make a living at any decent money, you know, you're going to play for a Broadway show. You know, you're not going to be a studio musician. And it just – those jobs just don't – you know, you can't make a good living being a studio musician anymore. And that was kind of an eye-opening thing to be reading about that. So
– yeah, it's kind of like being in the top film orchestras out here. There are only so many positions where you can really make a good living. And it's very competitive to get those seats, and that's the way Broadway is too. Yeah.
You've worked with show orchestras out here, right?
I've worked with film orchestras.
Well, film orchestras. Is that kind of a small, shallow pool as far as this, you know, the talent? I mean, basically it's the same people going to a lot of the different
sessions. Yeah, I mean, there are a few – depending on who the contractors are, they have different favorite people. But there are a few sets of people that seem to do all the top work. And I know when we are doing a real high-profile project, we'll always request people from that same group. Because, I mean, if you write any kind of intricate music, you need to have people in the seats who can read it fast and play it like they mean it really, really fast. And, you know, reputation is everything. And we learned pretty quickly after doing some orchestral work who were the people we'd call back a second time. And if you're a player out here, a professional player, you need to be on that short list.
Now, when you like for the Godzilla trailer or any of the other trailers you've done, when you hire a contractor, and the contractor is the one who actually finds the musicians for you, right? He's the guy who I need, you know, 100-piece orchestra. You mm-hmm. hire a contractor, and the contractor would hire the musicians, right?
Yeah, although we'll normally request, you know, here's who we want for concertmaster, here's who we want for first viola, you know, things like that. We don't just call them and say, hey, we need a 90-piece.
Right.
Make it happen, you know. Because also, you know, different players do have a different sound. I mean, yeah, if you have 20 violins and, you know, the person sitting in the 17th chair is not going to necessarily make a huge difference in the final recording. But, you know, having a different guy covering timpani or having you know, a different soloist.
Right.
You know, if you have a solo cello passage, then yeah, it's very important who's going to be playing that because different people would play it differently.
Now, do you rehearse them do you have like a day of rehearsal before you record, or do you rehearse and record on the same day?
No, usually you'd with the orchestras in LA are so good. You usually play it down once, that's the rehearsal, and then you take it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which you need to anyway. I mean, especially when we were doing trailers that way, it's so expensive to have them sitting in the seats.
That's true.
You need to just, you know, get it quick. So it's usually one rehearsal and that's it.
Yeah.
Guesstimate hourly cost a big orchestra studio. Just guesstimate.
It's on the order of $20,000 to $25,000 an hour.
Wow.
And something like that. For a 100-piece. You know, big symphony with the room and everything else that goes into it, cartage, everything.
See, now, you know, if I was really rich, I just might want to do that just because, you know. Not, don't have a CD collection. All you do is just contract out.
Contract the orchestra, have them sit there.
Okay, I want to hear a little bit of Beethoven now.
Yeah, the problem is for, you know, depending on what piece they're playing, it's a different configuration. So you got people coming in and out depending on what piece you want to hear.
Wow.
We're going to need 6 extra timpanis for this one piece.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, being in New York and going to the shows, it just – I got the live vibe, you know, of the live musicians. And I just I really think it's – you know, there has to be a balance somewhere with all this new technology that's putting musicians out of work. And yet you've got all this talent that's there that – I don't know. There's nothing like seeing a live show, you know. And mm-hmm. I don't think the shows would have been the same had there been, you know, tape playing in the background, you know. Mm-hmm. Although the audience may not have been any wiser to it,
They are. The audience knows the difference.
You think?
Mm-hmm. There's been plenty of union-based turmoil in New York, you know, based on one set of people wanting to use recorded music and how do we compensate the musicians. There's been plenty of turmoil about that. But audiences do know the difference.
Because you look at that and also you go to Vegas, though, where some of the shows, you know, had, you know, the union went through a whole thing, live players versus the tape. You know, some of the shows were going to tape as opposed to live players.
But some of them also were doing hybrids, which, you know, the moment you get somebody with a sampler and a disc recorder sitting there, and you have 3 keyboard rigs, a guitar player, bass player, and some weird instrument, you wonder, like, wait a minute, how are they getting all that sound?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you're going to go for the classic sound, if you're going to have a string section or a horn section, sure, you can do it on synths and samplers, but there's nothing like hearing a real horn in there. There's nothing like hearing a real strings in there. As opposed to if you're going to go see, like, the Blue Man Group, which is, you know, all rock and roll, then obviously you're going to have a lot of synths, you're going to have a lot of percussion and things like that. So anyhow, that was my trip to New York and the Broadway experience, which is...
Was it your first time?
No.
On Broadway?
It was the first time.
So were you like dancing on Broadway singing show tunes? Do you like letter to movies?
No, okay. No, I took my wife there for her birthday, and it was my first time being there and not working. I've been several times, but I've either been on a show or been on a tour or
I meant, was this your first time seeing a Broadway musical?
Oh no! It's I've seen other shows there, but I just think this time I was just so much more aware, you know,
of how it was being done
and how it was being done. But you know what I did do though? I went to David Letterman. I saw a taping of David Letterman.
Did you? Wow!
Last time I was there was when Stevie played David Letterman. Mm-hmm. Were you there?
Oh yes.
Remember when he played?
I won't forget that ever. It was a bit traumatic.
Why? What happened?
I know. Oh, it was the usual, you know, editing the song 3 seconds before they start taping. And,
that's right.
And I actually ended up sitting under Paul's piano during the show because I had to do some stuff to the Wayframe in the middle of the song, and that was the only place I could hide without, like, being in the way, because it's not – the performance area isn't as big as
– Right. It's tiny.
As you think it is.
I remember that.
And so I'm, like, sitting there crouched next to Paul's feet under the piano because it was the only place I could sit, and I had a 20-inch –
Do you like Letterman move?
It was quite interesting.
No, I remember
sitting on the floor with the monitor.
I remember that show because we set up, but there was literally no room for the crew to be. And I remember standing like by a door, and we actually didn't even go out there until the band went out there to get everything up and going. And I remember the set changes like literally was, you know, like 2 minutes. It's just it's just a commercial break. Boom! Everybody pulls everything out, and if you knew Stevie's rig at that time, that was
nothing happened fast. Well, the two things I remember are it was absolutely freezing in the studio.
Yes, which it still was.
And I was sitting under the piano actually shivering to the point where it looked like I was going to have a seizure. And Paul Schaefer got me a sweatshirt and a hat, which I still have. So that was really cool. So I have my Letterman sweatshirt. But the other thing I remember is I was waiting for Stevie to come in, and he had said that he needed to talk to me before he went on. So I was standing by the door. Mm. And someone said, excuse me, they had to walk by real fast. And so I took a step backwards and I just plowed into somebody and I heard, ow, like that. And I turned around, it was Letterman. He had just come out of the makeup room and I just like banged him against the wall. I have a
no wonder he gave you.
I have quite a history of that. I once knocked B. Arthur to the ground in a similar situation. Which, talk about that in a future podcast.
B. Arthur.
Yeah, B. Arthur and David Letterman. Two people much bigger than me.
Yeah, well, it was good to actually just see the show because
what a weird segue that was.
I know. Well, how do you segue from that, though?
Yeah,
so you just got to go for it.
Yeah, just change topic.
Well, actually, on the same topic, it was actually pretty enjoyable just being in the audience.
Great. Yeah, not having to work and not having to stress over it.
Not having to stress. Those guys, I mean, they have it just down.
Oh, yeah.
And the PA was phenomenal. I mean, not only do they have the regular flying monitor rig, but they also have underneath the balcony, like every 15 feet, they have a speaker that faces down. So, I mean, you will hear, and you will hear really, really well. It was almost a little loud, but it sounded great. So that was kind of fun. It was kind of fun doing that. On the going back to the time Stevie played Letterman, did you do the remember we did that gig in the record store?
I didn't go to that.
Stevie Wonder. Just imagine. Remember Stevie set up?
Mm-hmm.
We played a record store. That was kind of scary.
I'm so sorry I missed that.
But anyhow, Rob, I just want to thank you for covering too, because you did a great job.
And no problem. Thank you.
It was kind of fun.
I enjoyed the power trip. It was fun. Sitting up on the throne.
Yeah, you were way up there.
I know. It's cool.
Another great thing about New York, every building has like history.
Yes. It's a much older city than LA.
I mean, great history. David Letterman, you have the Beatles, you have Elvis, you have all kinds of really cool, because that was the Ed Sullivan Theater. Mm-hmm. The Hard Rock was another theater where that's where Nat King Cole used to play. That's where he first came out. I mean, it was just the Brill Building is right down there on Brown. I mean, it's just history.
And if you rub the sides of the buildings, you can actually see history going by.
<That's right. laughs> I really like history. So it was great just being able to actually not have to worry about getting to a gig and enjoy, you know.
Okay. Here's the big question. You're a Californian.
Right.
Now, for all those people out there, you know, California, the earth moves. So when you went in New York and you're walking down the streets and the subways go underneath you.
Right.
And then the ground starts shaking.
Yeah.
Did that make you a little weird?
Oh, no.
Not at all.
No, because you know it's a subway.
But sometimes you can't hear it though.
No, you can hear it. They have these grates all over.
Yeah, that never bugged me. Yeah.
I did that as well. And then you look up and you go, man, if there was an earthquake here, I'd be SOL.
Yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't be a great town for an earthquake. They have them every now and then. Yeah. But they're small.
But now they're talking about the big hurricane hitting New York.
Wonderful.
So we used to do a movie and a song about it. You can tell we haven't slept for a while.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, before this turns into the Nodcast for reals, I'm going to move on to what you were talking about, the wish list for the industry, because I was listening to what everybody had to do. And the one thing I wish that the industry could take care of is latency. Mm-hmm. I mean, latency is such, for me, it's such a big, big deal, especially when you're working with plugins against, you know, analog gear. And it's just, I mean, I've gotten tech calls. Martin's called me before. I want to tell a Martin story. Mm-hmm. You know, calls me up. And he was having a hard time figuring why his drums weren't staying in sync. They're not in sync. They're not in sync. You know, to the vocal that he just did. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to talk him through it. And okay, well, did you check this? Make sure this was in sync. Make sure that was in sync. You know, the whole thing. And then I go, are you doing any effects to your voice? Oh, yeah. I have the Cosmonaut plugin, you know, mm-hmm. and the, from the Bond Factory, I think they do that for Pro Tools.
Yeah.
I mean, it puts like 1800 milliseconds or some ridiculous thing of delay on it. And I said, that's why.
Yeah.
You know,
try using AltaVerbin 5.1 without the CPU or in CPU efficiency mode.
Right.
It was a second and a half out.
Wow.
And I sat there going, I was trying to create for shooting up the guns.
Right.
So yeah, I'm going to put a nice little room on them. Like, what's that? So, and I sat there and went, so I'm looking, I'm going through it. So then I sat there and said, let me see what the delay is. And I went, well, that just can't be. Was it 1.4, you know?
Right.
Or whatever. So I'm looking at it, I'm going, oh, that's just ridiculous. And then I realized in the page in the back, you know, and there's so many things, there's a checkbox that if you decheck, it'll make it less CPU efficient. But it defaults to CPU efficiency. And 5.1, there's just nothing efficient.
So when you checked it, it stressed the CPU.
Stresses the CPU a lot more. But hey,
it lowers the latency.
It lowers the latency. But I mean, a second and a half. I mean, I've heard of pre-delay, but that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. Well, for people that don't know what latency is, Rob, why don't you give a layman's definition?
Wait, say hello, Rob.
Latency.
Hello.
Hello.
That's latency. Latency is – it's actually – it's funny that people are so surprised to find out that their system has it because it's such a natural thing. It's just the processing time that it takes an audio process to happen. So if you have a sound that takes your voice and drops it an octave, say – it takes time for it to do the math to do that process, and that processing time is called latency. The good thing about the latency problem is that as time goes on, it gets solved by companies like Intel and Apple and Microsoft and all these companies that make the computers, because it's really just a matter of the processing speed of the computer. I mean, right now, latencies are way shorter than they used to be, and they're just going to keep getting smaller and smaller as computers get faster and faster. So latency is an issue that is going to be solved without any starving music companies having to put a bunch of time and money into it.
Well, yeah, and you got like Pro Tools with delay compensation and things like
that. Yeah, delay compensation is really the key. For today's audio equipment, delay compensation is the only way around it. And what that basically means is if you're playing a track back in a disc recorder that has delay compensation, it knows how long all the processes the sound is going to go through are going to take, and it just plays the sound early so that by the time it's all processed, it reaches your ears at the right moment.
But it should be region-based, not track-based.
Well, whatever it should be, that's not how it works now.
It's always track-based. Because you know what happens is a lot of times if you have dynamic automation – where you can turn things on and off.
Right.
What you're doing with any given sound, you're going to totally change different plugins at different points. But it's not smart enough for that. So if it was region-based, it would say, hey, at this point, this automation's happening, so we need to, you know, latency compensate X amount.
Well,
region by region, not track by track.
No, that's true. That would make a lot of sense because then you could you wouldn't have to worry about – well, especially if you're working the picture, you know, certain tracks.
No matter how you're processing, they'd be in time. But you know what? It's just now that all the manufacturers have their delay compensation working pretty well track-wise. I mean, they may do the region thing eventually, but it's still pretty recent that the track stuff is even working.
But when you start seeing things like the Icon, and now you're starting to get digital consoles that have plugins, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but all of a sudden, if you're putting something in and it's four frames out,
yeah.
two frames out.
No, that's bad.
Especially for dialogue, you're like, what happened? Or you're A-B-ing with the pec direct, and you're going, why does nothing match? And you're inserting on and off plugins. And that's common all the time. And now, all of a sudden, the computers, I just think it's not smart programming yet. I mean, I think that when they did it, they did track-based latency, but they really need to do region-based.
They will eventually, I'm sure. But even getting track-based working was so complicated. You know, these things always come in steps.
Yeah, we do Pro Tools 8.
Right. Yeah, it probably will be.
And you'll know before the rest of us.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know what? We're going to take a break. I know we spent a lot of time talking about a bunch of stuff up at the front end, but we're going to talk gear. What do you think about that on the backside of the podcast? Because I went to the that famous little street where they have Sam Ash and Manny's Music and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It got me thinking about gear. It got me thinking about buying gear. So we're going to talk about buying gear. We're going to talk gear when we come back from the break. So I will see you guys on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Are we rolling? Welcome back to the Audio Nowcast.
Once more with feeling.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, or as I should give credit to Rob because he actually coined the phrase before I stole it on the front half, the Audio Nodcast. I mean, if you can just see what everybody looks like right now, let's just say we've got a lot of half-open eyes. Are you guys driving home?
I think we're just leaning forward and eventually we're going to have
a lot of good night's sleeps needed tonight.
Yeah, wow. So, you know what? This is going to be one of those war stories for a podcast somewhere down the road. Yeah, remember that time we all stayed up, did an all-nighter and then did a podcast right after that?
It's 5 o'clock in the morning. Awesome. We're doing a podcast.
I went to New York. Yes, that was the theme of the evening, and got to go down to where all the music stores are, Sam Ash and Manny's Music. And it got me thinking about gear and buying gear. Right now I'm in the process of buying a synth. I've been doing my homework, and so far I've narrowed it down to the Korg, the Radius. Mm-hmm. I just think it looks cool.
It does look cool. It sounds cool.
It sounds cool. I like the presets. I like the fact that you can take the presets, you know, places. There's nothing worse than getting a synth and the presets are just ugly, you know. Yeah. I mean, true, you can go in there and create your own, but let's face it, how many of us have that kind of time? Mm-hmm. I don't. I usually find one I like to start with and just start, you know, tweaking knobs and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like it's a really, for what I need, which is I want to, you know, get an analog synth or a hybrid synth or a non-plug-in synth. I think it's the one that I'm going to go for. So I've been visiting a lot of music stores and things like that, and I wanted to bring up and talk to you guys about buying gear, the whole process of buying gear, because I came across some really bad salespeople. And let me just tell you, I've been to a couple different stores, and they're just some really, really bad salespeople out there.
That's most.
And, what's one of your biggest gripes about a salesperson? Like, what would really turn you off from a sales guy?
I mean, it's most salespeople turn me off. So, I mean, there are a lot of telltale signs. Right. I mean, I don't need a salesman who's going to answer any question with, well, let's go read the box. Or, you know, let's look it up on the web. You know, I can do that myself. Right. If someone represents to me that they know the product, they better really know it, because I'm going to find out real fast that they don't know it if they don't.
When was the last time that we had a traditional salesperson?
There have been lots of time periods when I had a salesman or a manager at a store who I really liked and had a relationship with for just buying any kind of professional gear. The problem is eventually those people leave their position. Like, you might have a favorite salesman at a store who will be there for a few years even, and then they go and you have no backup plan because you were always doing all your business with with one.
I think that's a really one of my biggest pet peeves is that the salesperson at, you know, a Guitar Center or any of the bigger music stores, they just turn over so quickly.
I've got a confession.
What?
I worked for GC for 3 months.
Did you?
That's Guitar Center for those who don't know the abbreviation.
Yeah, Guitar Center, yes. I actually opened the Guitar Center in Torrance. I was the first crew there and then.
Really?
Yeah, I needed to buy gear. So I went in and at that time, because you get the discount, you know, you got to be there 3 months.
Right.
So you get there, you work the 3 months, you buy the gear and you.
That's pretty funny because it's like. I could imagine you as a sales guy there.
Hi there.
There was a music store in Orange County called Jim's Music. It's actually still there. But they had the same sales guy there. When I first started out buying gear, he was there for years. His name was Tom. And the general manager who became the owner, or I don't know what exactly happened, his name was Rick. It was the one time where there was somebody at the store I could actually go to and talk to. And he was just a really cool guy, and he really taught me a lot. I learned a lot about MIDI, and I learned a lot about electronic music from visiting him. And actually, well, he's probably the most influential person in me, you know, going on the road and being a MIDI tech and things like that, because he really taught me a lot. You just don't – I don't see that happening nowadays.
Well, the thing is now, before you buy any piece of gear – you now have the luxury of being able to go on the internet and read a lot about it.
Or download it. I mean,
that's true if it's a software.
I mean, you
product.
Read it, you say, this is interesting. You download the demo, you try it out. If you like it, you pay the kind of dollars, you give them a credit card, and you're never even at a store.
But the thing is, if it is something that you do end up needing to buy at a store, if there's a salesman there, I want him to be able to add something beyond what the website gave me. And there are things they can add. Like they can tell you how their other customers feel about this product. If there are different competing products, they can tell you which one is doing best or which one has the best response. You know, there's still a place for a good salesperson to do their thing. But it's just not hard to tell when you're talking to the wrong salesperson.
Well,
it takes about 3 seconds.
But here's a question I have, because I have never done this on a music store, so... Here's the question I've got.
Right.
When you've got, let's say, software synths, and you're at a music store, the hardware is the Rolands, the Korg Yamahas, you sit there and you play it, and you go, oh, I like this one.
Right.
When you go to these stores, how do you try it out?
Well, some stores are set up.
With little
that.
Software stations. And
oh, yeah.
You and the libraries.
The good stores are, yeah. Well, every library, everything.
Well, yeah. And the other thing, too, is you can also, sometimes you download demos of some of the plugins.
But we're talking at the store itself.
Yeah, there are, I mean, like, I'll give them the plug, West LA Universal.
Right.
Out here, they have basically every virtual instrument set up, every library. You can hear just about everything they sell in a room, in one of the rooms there where you can go and actually play it on a keyboard and hear it. You know, if you want to hear the Vienna Symphony Library, which is incredibly complex, incredibly expensive, you can hear demos of it on their website, but before you drop $5,000, $8,000, $10,000, $11,000, whatever it is for the whole package, it's nice to know there's a store where you can go and sit down and actually play it and try it. And they do have it set up like that. And they're not the only store that does it. The best stores do have setups like
right.
that.
One of the reasons I set up a demo room is because I wanted people to have a place to come and have hands-on on some high-end gear, mm-hmm. as you were talking about, Rob, being able to touch and to actually use the gear. And when you're talking about high-end processing gear like EQs or mic pre's, a lot of that stuff, you don't know how good it sounds or how bad it sounds until you actually get to tweak it, to actually hear what it is when you sweep a filter or what it is when you get on a graphic and boost certain frequencies. And one of my philosophies here at Westwave is to provide a place where people can get their hands on some high-end gear. And I can take the plug-in equivalent of like the 560, and I can show people, here's the plug-in, and here's the actual real 560. And people will be able to hear, oh, this is what analog gear sounds like, and this is what the plug-in sounds like. And it's amazing how much you can really tell the difference on some of that stuff. And I know we've mentioned it before about plug-ins, and the real gear. And that's just basically my philosophy here over at Westwave is, hey, come in and try it out for yourself and get your hands on some of this gear. And
well, like Scott was saying, that is the most important thing, is to be able to take it for a test drive. I mean, and like I said, it's a luxurious thing for us that here in Burbank are places like West Wave and, you know, high-end dealers where you can actually try out the gear. I'd recommend if someone isn't near a dealer, there's probably still a way to rent the stuff and try it.
Right.
In a studio surrounding. But,
exactly.
Yeah, it's great. If you can find, especially for high-end gear, find not only a room where you can try it, but a room that has someone in it who actually knows the stuff inside and out.
Well, especially –
that's huge.
Especially if you're talking about high-end audio gear, if you can, you know, if you can find a studio that has a piece of the gear that you want to buy, because there's great places to buy high-end audio gear. You know, you've got Vintage King, you've got Mercenary Audio, you've got Sonic Circus, you've got West Wave. These are places where you can definitely get the gear at some really good prices. So just go to a studio, and if you're going to buy, you know, a $2,500 mic pre or something, or if you're going to buy a channel strip for that much money, it might be worth the $100 to go in and just to try it out mm-hmm. and to hear it. Especially with high-end gear, they all have their own characteristics and they all kind of have their own sound. And I just encourage people to find places where they can get their hands on the gear. I've bought from Musician's Friend. I've bought from American Music, you know, and I've always, you know, online I've always had a really pleasant experience. I've never really had a negative experience. But, you know, I only buy certain items from those type of stores. Any big ticket items like the Sends or any high-end gear, anything that I want to buy, I'm definitely going to go in because I want to touch it. I want to feel it. I want to see how the knobs are, especially a keyboard, the mm-hmm. action on the keyboard. It's just... there's something about going to a music store that's still very relevant. And the prices are pretty competitive.
Yeah. I mean, it's like always there are good stores and bad stores. And it's pretty easy to tell when you first walk in whether the people there truly understand the product or they're just trying to get boxes out the door. There really are, but there's not that many of them, but they're there.
When I first started in the business, I became a lighting designer and a live sound mixer at Disneyland while going to school. So I was out summers and winters. And a lot of times, especially when I first started, I didn't know anybody. So, you know, boom, I go to work. But off hours, you know, what are you going to do? So being the geek that I am, I went to the Santa Ana Guitar Center, especially in the daytime, because all my shows were at night.
I remember that off of Main Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So I at night, you know, I was always working. So I'd go down the middle of the day. Nobody's in the store. It's a work day. So I would go in, like, every day. And like just learn a synth or like do these shootouts with speakers. And they're like, what are you doing? Can I try these four speakers with this, you know? And they'd be like, what are you doing? So, and they started realizing what I was doing. And they actually dug it also because now all of a sudden either I would tell them what I found or that they wanted to hear it too. So I would go in and literally study a synth a day and just start getting knowledge. And it was kind of wild. I became friends with the guys down there and they, hey, oh, hey. And I'd help them wire the place because I had nothing to do. I was a geek, you know. Yeah, you know.
Well, see, but those, I mean, I really miss that kind of, I don't know. I just think the salesman back, you know, back in the day and the salesman today are, it's such a big box store. It's such a warehouse. I mean, there's definitely a place for, you know, the Guitar Centers and this Sam Ashes, but it's just there's something nice about, you know, the smaller stores, and even when Guitar Center was a little smaller where they had the sales staff, there was just something more of a community feel, you know.
Well, you know what is amazing when you talk about community feel? I'll give a little bit of plug. There's the Sound Designers User Group on Yahoo Groups.
Oh, yeah.
And what's great about that all the time is like a lot of new location recorders have come out, everything from the Diva to Sound Devices, and you know, and many times what happens is all of a sudden Roland will introduce something on Fostex, and then everybody's on the website going, okay, who's got what? What do you think? How do you compare it? And all the time, whether it's microphones, whether it's plugins, whether it's recording devices, somebody's always asking, what do you guys think about this? And then there's about 100 threads.
Right.
About that. And so the community's become virtual. And what's also nice is it's from people all over the world. I mean, it was people in Spain and France and England and Germany and Canada and US and Mexico. And it was interesting to see everybody's take on it and then how to do power issues. And
now, you know, you're right. That's definitely a community.
Well, you know what? Also, on one of the future podcasts, I have a guest who I'm going to bring who is actually one of the salesmen I deal with who does know the stuff inside and out. And one of the things that's so interesting about the way he does it is he monitors those user groups. He he pays attention to what the communities of users are saying, as well as what all the manufacturers are saying. And he has a real world perspective of how musical equipment fits into the world today. And he's definitely one of the go-to guys for me about, you know, just where things are headed and who's liking what and how different products are being received. Cause he's not just feeding you the line that the manufacturers want you to hear. He has a huge clientele, so he can give you their feedback, and also he's monitoring the stuff on the web and can tell you what that consensus is. There are still refreshingly smart salespeople out there who are on top of this stuff.
Yeah. You're going to have to give me his name.
I will. And he's already said he'll come on here in the next few weeks.
Is it JT?
No.
Okay.
And we're not going to play the initial game.
when I was putting
his
together...
His initials are XZ. No, that's not true.
When I was putting together the... I toured with Teddy Riley and put together a MIDI rig for him. And I went to actually the old Goodman's off of Lancashire. Remember that store?
That, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was really great. I mean, they had a great store. They had good salespeople. And I remember, I wish I knew what this guy's name was, but he really helped me a lot. I mean, we bought a ton of gear for that.
But that was the place that, like, all the pros supposedly.
Yeah. It was the best. That was one good. Of those places that for a while was our only place.
Yeah.
It was a great place. I mean, they really helped me out. They helped me out to the fact that, you know, we were going to buy the gear here, but because they didn't want to pay sales tax, it had to get shipped out of state because he was based back on the East Coast. And I had to learn, like, some gear. So I went up to the guy and I said, hey, man, can I just get the manuals? You ship the gear. Just give me the manuals. So he gave me the manuals on a couple pieces of gear and that I had to know when I got over there. And it was just, you know, that kind of service, you know.
It's a good thing they've gone out of business because otherwise the IRS would now descend upon them thanks to you telling that little
story. See, there's a porta potty in Las Vegas with an address on it. It's got like hundreds of boxes around it. So everyone from California drives out to Nevada, picks
Actually,
up their box.
No joke, it was Tucson, Arizona's the store where that used to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
shall
no.
remain nameless, but boy, was that a good time.
But I knew studios that actually used to ship consoles to like nowhere in Vegas. It wasn't even a store. They bought it in L.A. They shipped it to Vegas, picked it up in Vegas, and brought it back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they shipped the gear back there, so I don't think they did anything wrong, you know?
They just got the manual. They're not supposed to take the manual out before they ship the gear.
That's going to be the big question.
Okay.
I don't think it's much of a question. I think it's pretty much
Really? You don't think they? You think that was against the law?
Uh-huh.
They bought the gear. They paid for the gear over on the East Coast.
They paid for the manual as part of the gear.
Man, all of a sudden, I just feel bad.
and
That's okay. Know, like I say, they went out of business. Actually, they got sold. But, so
well,
somebody else owns them now.
It may have been my fault.
It may have been.
But you remember when everybody – when?
No, actually, I know why they went out of business. It wasn't your fault.
Okay,
do you remember when the dollar was high and the yen was low?
Yes.
All these guys from would go to Japan buying – tons of Yamaha gear, I remember, come back to the apartment and just sell it all off. All the DX7s. And,
yeah, mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, I remember. It's like, and it was so much cheaper.
That's when you could open up the recycler, which is a, back then, and it's actually it's still around.
The
and
edge,
you could,
yeah,
just, the you could just see all that gear that was in there. You know.
Oh, the first tour I ever did with Stevie in Hong Kong, we had a good time.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a place called Tom Lee Music in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
That was selling all the same stuff as you'd find in the States, but just so much cheaper.
So for all those people in the other countries, what we're saying is now you get to come to the States, buy the stuff cheap, and then go home.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, because the dollar's kind of low now.
Actually. So anyhow, let's get back on topic for a second.
Just for a second.
Actually – that was buying gear, so we're still on topic. It's not too bad.
We're talking about smuggling, you know.
Yeah, gray market.
Gray market stuff. You know?
There you go. If you're going to buy gear right now, if you want to give some people advice on buying gear, Rob, what would be like one big piece of advice? If someone was out there in like Kansas and was going to think about buying a synth, what would you say? What would be a little tidbit of information?
You know what? At this point, I would say – you know, read the manufacturer's web pages and stuff, but immediately find the forums and the communities on the web where the users of these instruments talk to each other. You know, there's a forum or there's a BBS or whatever you'd call it called KVR Audio that a lot of the different manufacturers have forums on. And it's not that fine to – it's not – let's try that again. It's not that hard to find a forum on any piece of software or hardware.
That's true.
Google it and look for it. Yeah. And then find out the kind of stuff that people are complaining about. Find out what people are saying is great. Beware that if you go to a forum about any piece of software, most of the complaining that you'll usually see, if it's complaining by people who don't understand the product, it's usually people who have bootleg pirated copies of the software. Yeah. So you have to take some of that with a grain of salt. But like when I've been in the market for an analog modeling synth, I wanted to know what the synth tweakers out there were thinking. I just found forums where they talk about it. And I've always found the information there to be good on average. I mean, you have to kind of weigh it as a whole. You can't, if there's one person ranting because they hate the filter on some synth, but everybody else likes it, well, you have to just take that person's opinion with a grain of salt. But I try to read as much as I can from people who are using the stuff I'm thinking of buying, and then that holds a lot of weight in my decision.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would say I know it's a revolutionary thing to say, but use the internet.
Wait, what's the internet again?
Well, that's next week. We'll talk about that.
Scott, any advice?
Yeah, I mean,
buying gear?
Yeah, you know, it's whether it be synths, whether it be microphones, whether it be speakers, I'm a strong believer in test driving, whether it's downloading demos from the internet or going to the store. I mean, a lot of times I get asked, you know, what speakers should I buy? What do you like? And, you know, and a lot of people like different things. A lot of people are, you know, whether it's high-end, tight, low-end, good mid-range, smooth, bright. It's something that I recommend, shootouts as much as possible, getting your friends together. If you are really aggressive, some things that I've done is I've gone out and bought 6 pairs of speakers and returned 5. And, yeah, okay.
But no, we have a real luxury being in L.A. If you're in the middle of Kansas and there's not a music store for 100 miles,
it's not obviously the internet and looking reviews and networking to see what people are interested in. But even music stores out there, whether it's an instrument, a guitar, you know, go out and find what works for you in your tastes with your style, with your set of ears. Again, downloading demos are great. I get asked a lot of times, you know, what do we go, PC or Mac, which we could probably do its own little podcast on. And I always
say – that's easy. That's easy to answer.
And I always say find the software you like and then buy the hardware that fits it.
Right.
Rather than the other way around. Or, hey, buy both. Test driving, I think it's really important. And I think that a lot of people out there – you know, the stores have gotten pretty sophisticated. And I think there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Before you buy anything, too, find out what the return policy is of wherever you're going to buy it, because that varies widely.
Yes, especially if you're going to return 5.
Okay, well, my advice, number one, it has to do with used gear. If you're going to buy a used synth, first thing you should do is make sure all your outputs work and that there's no shorts on the outputs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's like the very basic.
Because you may not find that out till much later. You may not need all the outputs initially.
Well, because how many times do you see people go into a store or something and they'll put the headphones on and they'll use the headphone jack and they'll demo the keyboard, you know, coming out of the headphone jack.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even know if the outputs are even working. So, I mean, test
every single knob and every key also.
Yeah, because I was a victim of that. That's why I
really
that I bought a used synth and I listened to it on the headphones and it was great. And I just did not think about plugging it on the output. And it was a Wave Station, and I wanted a Wave Station for so long. And mm-hmm. I found one. It was like $300. I'm like, yeah, Wave Station. So I bought it. And yeah, the headphone works good, but one of the jacks there was a little short, so you could jiggle it and it would cut in and cut out. Mm. You know, it was pretty actually easy to fix, but still it was just like, oh, man, I should have had it.
Because that problem can also – I mean, it could be a bad D to A converter or something that isn't so easy to fix, and then you're stuck.
And then you're stuck with a good headphone.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was going to ask you guys, do you guys ever buy off eBay?
Yes.
No.
I
good experience? Bad experience?
Actually, it was a strange experience. I've bought a bunch of stuff off eBay. I bought like a business phone system and then a bunch of telephones to go with it from a bunch of different sellers. And, you know, no one element was all that expensive. And I got a few duds that weren't worth, you know, pursuing the sellers because it just wasn't worth the money.
You mean they didn't ship you the right stuff?
Well, they shipped it, but it was like not working perfectly, or it was more banged up than it looked in the pictures or whatever. But my first experience ever was I bought, back when we used to use these a lot, an SVHS professional deck, a Panasonic, that Scott, your company used a lot of too. And it was a great deck. It was like a $7,000 or $8,000 deck, and I found one for about $1,500. And the guy in the eBay ad said, oh, it works perfectly. It's like mint condition. It's just perfect. And the thing showed up, and I paid the $1,500 through PayPal. And the thing showed up, and it had a tape jammed in it and was like completely mangled and destroyed. And I just thought, oh, no, you know, I've got this deck here now, but it's in bad shape. And I contacted the seller, and he turned out to be a really nice, upstanding guy. And he said, well, just get a quote to get it fixed, and I'll send you the money to get it fixed. And it was about $800 of service that the thing needed, and he sent me the $800, and I got it fixed. And I still have it. It works perfectly. So that was an unbelievably lucky situation.
That was
situation.
Really – I've never heard of that.
That was my
before.
First ever purchase on eBay, though.
And what about finding a $1,000 bill on the street?
Yeah, no,
that hasn't happened.
Your first
– My first purchase on eBay, because I wanted one of those decks, and the cheapest I could find one in town was like $6,000 for a used one.
Now you can't give them away, you know.
Well, you know what it was? He had a production company doing wedding videos and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And – I think what it actually was they had a bunch of these decks, and the one he sent me wasn't the one we had been talking about. I think that's what happened. Because he didn't want it back. They were going out of business, and he didn't want the deck back.
How did he know that you weren't just saying that? I mean, that's just so odd.
I guess I sounded honest.
If I went, he got that deck.
You know what? Yeah, he didn't even try to, like, run and hide from the situation, so.
Wow. So he probably knew and just was like, okay, I'm just
going
to deal.
But it worked out great.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. You probably got, like, a whole new assembly or something out of that.
Yeah, they had to replace the whole transport. It was, like, it was as bad as if you shoved a VHS tape in upside down. It was that bent and destroyed.
You can't do that?
You can if you're strong enough, I guess.
Scott? eBay? Ever buy anything off eBay?
No, my wife buys eBay tons of times, and I've always been a little spooked because a lot of the stuff that I'm buying is kind of high-end, and it's not cheap, and I'm not sure what condition it's in. So if I'm buying, you know, microphones or outboard gear, I don't know what I'm getting. So I have to admit I haven't really done the eBay thing yet.
You know what? I'm with you. I haven't bought nor sold a dang thing on eBay.
I want to sell a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I want to sell some stuff,
too. If anybody wants Atari computers, I got tons of them.
Do you have the Stacy?
I have two Stacys.
Do you really?
I have two Stacys. I have things that like never even saw the light of day.
Wow.
Yeah, I had an endorsement, and I've got about 12 Atari computers.
Do you have the little pocket one? Remember they came out with a little tiny little...
Oh, the little laptop? You know what was amazing about
Atari?
Not even
a laptop. It was like one of the first PDAs.
No, I didn't have the one.
Oh.
But what was great about it was, I mean, these devices came out, the Falcon,
right.
8 channels of disc recording, $1,000, and MIDI built into it at a time when the cheapest one was $100,000.
Yeah.
And they couldn't sell them. Everybody wanted them. There were like lines across town for them. But every time Atari made something amazing that they could sell just tons and make tons of money, they couldn't manufacture them.
Oh, man.
And then all the stuff they did manufacture, nobody wanted.
And the fact that Atari was purely the second coolest computer at the time because there was Amiga, which was clearly the coolest computer.
No, I don't know. I thought, you know, there's the Atari Amiga Wars, you know?
I know. I was on the Amiga side of things.
And then Macintosh said, that'll never take off. You know, Apple, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Because it didn't come with MIDI, so everyone said, you know, just got to blow off Apple, you know. Yeah, okay.
If you want a laptop with MIDI, I got a stack of Yamaha C1s.
Yeah, it's okay.
Remember those things?
Yeah, I remember. Ooh.
The C1s.
No, C1 do you remember Crepo?
Eight MIDI ports on the back.
The Crepo Cray Pro computers. They were this giant brick, and the front plate came off. It was a keyboard with the monitor and disk drives built in.
And it only
weighed like 80 pounds.
The Osborne.
Well, that was another one. Osborne was one. Compaq had one that looked like that.
Yeah, it was huge.
So did Commodore. Remember the Commodore 64 had one that had a little built-in.
That was my first computer.
The Commodore 64. And now you can buy emulators on pocket PCs and run all those programs. How crazy is that?
Yeah.
How crazy is that my first big SCSI drive was 9 gigs and cost like $6,000?
Yeah.
And I looked at the Fry's ad today, and you could buy an 8-gigabyte compact flash card for $130.
Oh, yeah. I remember sitting at an AES. We were yelling at AMS because we had the AMS audio file.
Right.
Saying a 600 meg drive is not worth a penny over $10,000. Mm-hmm. We're not going to pay because they said it's $20,000. No, it's not worth a dime over $10,000 for 600 megs. Hey, and you needed like four or five of them, you know.
With the Synclaver, we were paying that much for drives? 10 meg drives.
Yeah.
Well, how about the RAM for the Synclaver, though?
Hey, 4 megs. All right.
Well, RAM for the WaveFrame was pretty obscene, too. Those giant cards.
32 megs. Oh, the sizes of them.
It was $1,000. No, it was almost $2,000 a meg.
Yeah.
Bargain.
Woo-hoo. Let that sink in. $2,000.
But you know what? Meg. Not even that far ago. We had 9 gig drives, which were about $800.
I know.
Now, theoretically, if you do the math, it's worth about 9 cents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For a 9 gig drive.
That's crazy.
Because a 200 gig drive is $200.
You know? That's. I think one thing for me, this whole technology thing of just this built-in obsolescence.
And then.
Boy, am I tired.
It went the way of the Cray-Pro computer.
Anyhow, one reason why I went to a hardware synth is because I'm so sick of the upgrade cycle. And so I'm actually trying to go a little bit more hardware on.
But you know what? Even that hardware synth, they'll have software updates for it on the website.
Well, but that's true too. But at least you don't have to worry about, you know, you get the synth, you get that sound, and you can, even if you don't upgrade it, even if you don't want it, any more features, it is what it is, and you can always plug it into your board, and you can boom, you can just work right off the bat. Mm-hmm.
You know? But you know, we were talking about acquiring gear, and one of the coolest ways that I acquired gear early on is that we used to trade closets. You have a bunch of gear that's sitting in a closet. You don't use. And I remember giving that a friend of mine had a guitar amp, a practice amp, that I thought it would be great. And I had a Commodore 64 sitting in my closet just collecting dust. And it doesn't matter because they're both pretty much worthless.
Right.
So you can't say, well, mine originally cost me X. And no, they're both worthless piece of gear that theoretically you would throw out to make room. So you just trade. You say, here's my closet of gear. You give me your closet of gear. And then you acquire new gear that way.
Yeah, but you're just trading. You're swapping closets full of stuff that neither one of you is ever going
to
use.
Well, no, but I wanted a practice amp that I thought that would be a great little practice amp to have. And he wanted a Commodore 64. So, you know, we traded, and I do that occasionally. You know, because you got to remember, there's people that, especially when you find people that have a lot of high-end pro gear, there's people that you know, or you give – I've given gear away, you know, for like $10. Like, here, take all this, $10, buy me lunch, whatever. And it's worth thousands of dollars in its day, but now it's worth nothing. Mm-hmm. But and the person who loved it and thought it was great because it was an up-and-coming young person, and you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay, send your emails in to audio@nowcastnetwork.com if you want Scott's closet. He's going to trade a closet full of gear.
And get ready to have a lot of Atari show up.
So, guys, I think we pretty much exhausted the topic.
I know we exhausted ourselves.
That is until the AES show.
That's right. And that's one thing I wanted to mention is you know, I'm going to be going to the AES show, so I'll be in the API booth if anybody ever wants to come in and say, hey, I listen to you, and we laugh at you every other week. Then, yeah, you can be there. Are you guys going to AES this year?
Depends on how the projects I'm working on finish up. If I can get there, I will, but it's not looking good.
What about you, Scott?
I am, actually. I'm speaking at a Dolby seminar on Sunday morning at 8:30.
Are you really?
About interactive mixing for video games.
Is it? Do you have to be registered for the conference?
I
could you get me in? I don't know. I'm going to be working there in the API booth.
So you got a hotel room?
Do I have a hotel room?
Hey, big boy.
Well, yes, but what are you saying, Scott?
Oh, San Francisco and all.
But
there's a big edit. There's a big edit.
Boy, it's getting late. We have not slept, have we?
No.
But Scott and myself will be there, and Rob will be there if he can make it. So stop on by the API booth and say hey. But other than that, thanks, guys, for staying awake.
Our pleasure.
Hey there. Hi. Oh, sorry.
We already did our homework.
Oh, we did that? Okay.
Yeah, this is the goodbye. So on behalf of a very tired Rob, hey. Scott, Andrew, and myself, you know, actually I'm getting a second wind. I'm ready to go for a whole nother hour.
Oh, go for it. I'll see you later.
All right. We'll catch you next time.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.